Chapter 29. Ronnie, Liverpool. In the ensuite, Graham splashing cologne, singing along to a song, getting ready for his night on the town. I don't care, but shape my face into a semblance of sadness. I want him feeling bad at the image of me sitting alone with hot chocolate and a pile of marking, when really, I'll be on my date with Tom. A smile crosses my face, but I quickly hide it when Graham sashays into the bedroom. For the last couple of weeks, Tom's phoned my office at 1 o'clock. Students were astounded when I rushed past them and ignored their behaviour to catch his call. They probably thought I'd turn soft. But I loved our quiet chats. Just him and our little oasis. No teenage angst or teacher demands. He shared his love of music, old TV shows like Kojak, and that he'd always yearned to play guitar. Sometimes we spoke about personal stuff, like our upbringing and how our parents had fucked up our views of the world. Mine because they were poor, and his because of their riches. Not once did I feel the need to snare him. Graham edges onto the bed and flashes a shy grin. His usual little boy imitation. He's waiting for permission, like I'm his mother, instead of his girlfriend.
You sure this is okay, Ron?
Of course it isn't, but it won't be me that says, "No, you're a selfish bastard." Let him have his freedom and revisit his youth, but I'll be doing the same. Of course, go and have fun with your mates. It's fine, I told you before. He pecks a kiss on my forehead and flees from the room, trying to outrun his guilt. He doesn't want it clinging to his new T-shirt. That would surely dampen his sex appeal. Not that I'll be doing anything like that with Tom. I made that very clear from the beginning, and he's fine with it. He just enjoys my company. I guess he's lonely.
Ron, I'm off then. You sure you don't want me to come back here tonight?
No, it's fine. I'm just going to get an early night, and you'll wake me up. It's been a long week. I'm exhausted.
So, you'll come over to mine in the morning, then?
Yeah, about lunchtime.
Okay, babe. Have a nice night.
You too. And wear a condom. His laugh splinters my civility. It wasn't a fucking joke. The front door slams behind him, and I wait. Drum my fingers on the bedside cabinet, flex my ankles until his rat friend's car scuttles along the road towards its dirty destination. 1 hour to get ready for hot date Tom. I throw the covers off the bed, rip off my nightie, and rush to the bathroom. It's dark, and a gentle kiss of rain dampens the air. The streets are quiet, except for a couple of women embracing in a corner. A street light illuminates the drizzle around them, and the hazy glow makes them appear angelic. The memory of Tara's smile flashes through me. It makes me sad. I'm always losing friends in some way or another. The women part and move on, giggling at some private joke. I wrap my coat around me against the rain. We're going to see Friday the 13th, an old horror film. Tom chose it. He loves horror and has all the original Hammer House movies collected at home. Frankenstein is my favourite. I've always felt sorry for the monster, all alone in the world. But then, if he'd found love, it would have betrayed him eventually. So he was probably better off.
Hey, Ron.
I gasp. Because the voice sounds just like Graham's. But it's Tom, and he waves from across the road. I'm glad I've dressed down in jeans and a jacket. He's casual too, although he's in white trainers, and I'm strutting my stuff in red high heels. You can't be too laid back. Not on a date. Sorry I'm late. A spot of rain in Liverpool comes to a standstill. His blonde hair, normally straight, has curled up his collar. It's cute. Perhaps I've been waiting all my life for this. A few extra minutes won't make any difference. He leans forward, brushes his lips to my cheek, and unzips his jacket. An urge to flee turns my head away. I'm not sure how to react, for in his hand is a single red rose. He shuffles his feet, hands in pockets.
Too much.
No. Perfect. I smile. Thank you.
I was scared you'd snap it in two.
I laugh. He joins in and, somehow, he's holding my hand as we enter the foyer.
Best teacher in the world, huh?
Tom holds up the one surviving mug from the hundreds I've been gifted over the years. It always sits on my kitchen windowsill, wherever I live in the world. Arfan had given it to me just after he turned 13. He hadn't seen his 14th birthday. He was dead by then. Another statistic of stabbings and gangs. He'd been a great student, a beautiful boy. I remove it from Tom's hands and replace it where it belongs. It needs to feel the sun every morning. Tom's shoulders drop.
Sorry, Ron. I shouldn't have touched it. I guess it means something special to you. Want to talk about it?
No, thanks. Put some music on and I'll grab some wine. It's weird having Tom in my home. It's like a crossing of lines. But we've had such a good night that neither of us wants it to end. It had been so funny when the hand rose from the leak at the end of the film and he'd screamed. And it's just a few drinks between friends. Nothing like what Graham will be up to. I grab two glasses and a bottle of red. Music welcomes me into the living room, where Tom is dancing on the sofa. He's weaving my red silk scarf through the air. I giggle, not quite believing my eyes. What are you doing?
I'm giving myself up to the moment.
He jumps down and saunters over to the window, tilts his head to the side, places his hand by his ear.
Can you hear drums?
I shake with laughter. His eyes close and he sings along with the lyrics. I collapse onto the sofa in fits of giggles, my cheeks sore from laughing. He's nuts. Tom?
Yep.
Why are you floating my red scarf about? He snaps his fingers in the air, then places his hands on his hip.
He's from Spain, isn't he?
The scarf twirls above his head. Then, with a flourish, he brings it to his feet.
I'm a bullfighter. Ole!
Tears run from my eyes. Fernando is from Mexico?
You're wrong.
You're thinking of Angelo. He's from Mexico. That's the Brotherhood of Man, you idiot. This is ABBA, and I'm pretty sure they're both Mexican. He throws the scarf onto a chair.
I knew that! I knew that!
He laughs. Super Trooper plays, and he runs over, grabs my hand and pulls me up to my feet.
Come on, let's harmonise. You be the redhead.
I'll be the blonde.
Wait! I grab my wine and down the glass. He does the same. I narrow my eyes and throw him a glare. He fake flinches, gasps, and draws a hand to his mouth. I'm Agneta. You're Frida. A snap. He smiles, and we take our positions, standing back to back. We only stop for wine, the loo, and to catch our breath. When Waterloo starts, we're too exhausted to even shout the first words. With sweat dripping from our faces, we collapse to the floor.
Ronnie?
Yeah?
Where's Graham? I've asked you before and you've avoided the question.
I inhale deeply and sigh. He's out with his mates, clubbing. Tom shakes his head.
I just don't get it. If you were mine, I'd never leave your side.
You would, Tom. 1D. He slides along the floor and brushes the damp hair from my face. Placing a finger under my chin, he brings my eyes to his.
I wouldn't.
Yeah,
I've heard it all before. And I had. Many times from so many men, all with different faces, but spouting the same lines.
You haven't heard it from me.
I'm with Graham, I say. Tom takes my hands into his.
Graham doesn't care about you.
Don't you see that? Maybe he's right. No one else ever has. But wait, that's the point, isn't it? I have to make Graham love me. Be the perfect match. Everything's going to plan. If it's too easy, it won't be worth it. And I won't have proved a thing. But have I got that wrong? Tom's warm hands reach up and cradle my face. He searches my eyes, as if he can read every crack of my soul. All those unsaid hurts that would choke me if I let them out. When he lowers his mouth to mine, I kiss him back. When he lifts my top and touches my breasts, I let him in. We don't make it to bed, and it's beautiful to let go. We fall asleep holding each other's hands. What's that noise?
It's nothing.
Tom whispers.
Go back to sleep.
What if Graham's come over?
It's not him. Everything's okay.
I rustle in the dark and I spread my arm out searching the floor. I find the top I'd worn earlier and throw it on. Where are you, Tom? Crawling over to the lamp, I fumble for the switch to turn it on. Something doesn't feel right.
Why don't you go back to sleep? Everything's fine.
The glare of the bright light blinds me and I rub at my eyes. Everything is far from fine. Tom is sitting on the edge of a chair, fully clothed and tying his shoelaces. What's going on, Tom?
He smiles. I've got to get going. I've a busy day later.
I stare at him open-mouthed. Even though I know the rules state I'm meant to smile and nod, pretend it doesn't bother me, that it's okay for him to fuck and run. Can't show his words, whispered in the night, might mean anything at all. Have to hide the hurt and fake it out. But I had a brilliant night. It's just I'm away for the next 6 months at the new office in Gibraltar and I've still to pack. I storm towards him, fists clenched tight at my side. Are you fucking joking? You're sneaking out at 3 in the morning? A lopsided smile spreads to his eyes and he bends to pick up his jacket.
Oh, come on. What did you expect? It's all part of the game. Look at all the places we met. Hardly take your girl home and introduce her to your mother, Terrain.
My fists uncurl. Tears spill. The room spins and my head bows. He ambles over, leans down, and places a dry kiss on my wet cheek. I'm left there like a used blow-up doll as he strolls down the hall to escape. I sprint after him, grab the back of his head, and wrap his hair around my fingers. He pushes me away, but I tighten the hold. Then I tilt my head and hurl spit in his face. Get out of my fucking house, you scummy bastard! He cleans his face with the sleeve of his jacket. You're a fucking psycho, Ronnie. I pity you.
Get out. Get out. Get the fuck out.
I scream and push him through the door. His foot stops me from slamming it shut and he snarls.
Not a bad fuck, but I've had better. No wonder Graham plays around.
He winks and struts down the path like a feral tomcat. With trembling hands, I turn the key in the lock. Slump to the floor, draw my knees to my chest, and lean back against the wall. I'm an idiot. Have I not had enough experience to recognise the lure of the bastards? The ones that make you fly with their words, then slice your wings with their actions? My eyes flinch towards the ring of the doorbell. I can't believe he's back!
Get the fuck away from here, or I'll phone the police, you bastard! bastard!
The bell rings once more, and his hands hammer the door. I pounce to my feet. I'll kill him this time!
Ronnie, it's me, Graham. Let me in, please. I have a confession.
Chapter 30. Ronnie, the beach. Flames rise to smoke the air. Sparks crackle, dance and softly fade. Around a fire pit, wrapped in blankets, all three of us sit and stare out to the waves. The gatekeeper in bare feet, with his trousers rolled up past his ankles, paddles there. Occasionally he stoops to hold a shell to his ear, as if a story will be revealed. My stomach cramps in spasms. I twist my head to the side, bent over, and vomit hits the ground. With the back of my hand, I wipe my mouth clean. Tears drench the sand. How dare he pull me back here? I rip the blanket from my shoulders, stand and yell down, "Get me back to Graham!" The wet sand sinks around my feet as I stride towards him. He scratches his head as he holds a coin to the light. I said, "Get me back! I want his confession!" His face contorts into a grin. Or maybe it's a grimace. He crouches, dips his hands into the sea, and offers me cupped palms.
"These waters are blessed by the goddess Lethe. They will bring you forgetfulness. Is that not what you wanted, such a short time ago?"
My eyes dart to his hands. I stumble back, slip and fall. He smiles and lets the water drip slowly through his fingertips.
"It would appear you've changed your mind, Ronnie. And you may be right. Is the loss of memory really such a mercy? Lethe had many sisters and brothers. Some were liars, others were storytellers. But she loved them all. We never get to choose our family, do we, Ronnie? But they're the only ones who really know us. Don't you think?"
"What the fuck you on about?" I snap. He waggles a gnarled finger in front of me.
"Remember your manners, young lady."
Any closer and I'll take his finger to my mouth and bite. "Ronnie, you're back!" Nikki squeals, running towards me. And before I get to my feet, she's got her arms around me, squeezing me tight. "Come on, come sit at the fire and get warm." There's something so sweet about her. It annoys me, but it also brings fresh tears to my eyes. She grabs my hand, and I let her lead me back. She picks up the blanket from the ground, spreads it out between her arms, and shakes it. My eyes squint against the sand flying from it. "Where did the blankets come from?" I ask. She shrugs and lays the blanket around me. "Dunno, they were sort of here." I sit down on a boulder. It sends a shiver through me, and I lean into the fire to warm my hands. "And the bar? It's disappeared."
"Yeah, looks that way."
"Great. I could have done with a strong vodka."
Nikki laughs, nods, lifts her knees to her chest and cocoons herself in her blanket. Hawthorne sits next to her with her face scrunched around pursed lips. Miserable old bitch. I need to get out of here and back to Graham. Had he seen Tom leave? Oh God, what if he had? He'd be so angry. And what the fuck was he going to confess?
"He's loathsome,"
Hawthorne says.
"Who?"
I ask. "Does she mean the gatekeeper or Charles?" She rolls her eyes.
"Tom, of course. I really dislike him. But how didn't you see it coming?"
"He was a nice guy. He wasn't like that in the beginning." She laughs.
"A nice guy that you met at a perverted sex thing. How unexpected."
A storm of anger engulfs me. I want to grab her blanket and throw it in the sea. But she's old. It wouldn't be right. And what does she know about Tom? Maybe it was my fault. Maybe I reacted too hastily. If I'd let him leave, things might have turned out differently. She didn't know he was going to turn out that way. It's not her fault. I think you're being a bit cruel, Nicky says.
Oh, let her say what she wants, Nicky. She's a bitch anyway.
Hawthorne crosses her legs and brushes specks of sand from her trousers.
I'm only telling the truth. What is it about you that you choose despicable men? Men that use you like a toy. Anyone could have seen what Tom had planned.
Could they have? He'd been different from a normal type. Easygoing. Kind. And he'd chased me from the start. Or had that been through our meetings of chance? The praise and declarations he made usually suffocate me. But with him, it had been different. Why? Are you okay, Ronnie?
Nicky perches beside me. She's rubbing my arm and her face, with an eyebrow raised, tilts too close to mine.
I'm fine. I want to get back, that's all.
To Graham? She whispers.
Yeah, I need his confession.
Oh, I wouldn't be in too much of a rush, dear. He probably wants to tell you he has syphilis, or that he's got some poor girl pregnant. He's just the type.
Hawthorne says. Nicky gasps, and her fingernails bite through my blanket to pinch my arm. Both of us turn and glare over to where Hawthorne sits on her moral throne.
Not that I would personally be acquainted with such people. I shop at Waitrose.
Nicky giggles, and I slap my thigh in amusement. Hawthorne throws us a scowl. We dissolve into laughter. It goes on and on. We clutch our stomachs, stamp our feet, and still it comes. Nicky snorts. My cheeks ache. Breathless, we cling to each other. But still, the laughter spills from us. It tumbles across the sand and rides the waves where the gatekeeper stands. He looks over and frowns. A chill floods the air. The fire hisses, snaps out.
Look what you've done,
Hawthorne says. I walk over to her. Oh, be quiet, second-hand rose.
I've never worn a hand-me-down in my life, dear.
Oh, I thought you wore Clarissa's jewellery. I thought you were given a choice of 5 rings.
Her head bows. But instead of feeling happy, I'm ashamed.
What the hell am I doing picking on a woman? An old one at that.
The gatekeeper thumps an old wooden oar against a rock. 5 is a special number, Ronnie. You shouldn't be so fast to dismiss such things. There are 5 waters here. The Lethe, the Acheron, the Cocytus, the Phlegethon, and the Styx. Each has its own emotion associated with death.
He turns to Hawthorne.
Sometimes, having 5 options is a good thing.
I've no idea what he's talking about. He's a raving clown. 5 waters and options. Maybe if I pay more attention, rather than obsessing about Graham, I'll figure it out. But I'm more interested in getting back.
Nicky is cradling Hawthorne in her arms.
Surely it should be her, as the youngest, who's being comforted.
I'm sorry for her, dying so young. She'd be a nice person to know, in different circumstances.
Are you okay, Nicky? I ask, moving towards her.
She shakes her head.
Not really. I'm scared of what I'll find. What if Gio is just like Tom?
Oh, it's her turn to go back.
What if I get closer to her, cuddle her in? Would I go back too?
The gatekeeper growls. No, Ronnie. You all take your turns. How could you be judged fairly if you each have unequal time?
Judged for what?
Nicky asks. She's trembling and very pale.
Your love,
he replies.
I spit at the ground. As if love might ever be wrong. As if it's ever as simple as one word. And Nicky's eyes glaze over.
Chapter 31. Nicky, Mondello. Scraping my hair back into a ponytail, I splash water on my face. It's just gone 10 in the morning, and this must be the 100th time. When I catch my image in the mirror, I wrinkle my nose and grimace. What a state! The heat has destroyed my beauty routine and left me like a lobster in a frazzled wig. There's no point in wearing makeup. It melts as you slap it on. And believe me, I've tried. Even my mascara dripped into puddles and stung my eyes. I'd never be seen dead like this in Edinburgh. But here I've no choice. How can Gio even fancy me like this? The worst of it all is the baggy, shapeless dresses and the medieval rules. Gio lied. And in this heat, well, it's just easier to comply. He's become a different person since we arrived in Palermo. Before, it was all kiss chase on the beach and shots with my pals. But here, he sticks to me like a leech. And when he has to work, I'm grounded alone in this shitty home. With no television, I sit for hours on the balcony, wishing I could join the world, but I'm not allowed. I drag myself across the hot tiles to the kitchen. Damp footprints linger behind me. I'd go back and dance in them, make pretty patterns on the floor, blast some music and sing like a pop star for a while. But the clammy air has stolen my spirit, and I need a drink and ice to revive it. It's ridiculous to tie rope around a fridge, but Gio says the catch isn't tight enough, and we can't buy new, not yet. My hands grip the frayed ends. Sweat dribbles from my face, and my palms sting against the coarse edges. I pull, clutch at a thread, but it tears off in my hand, and the knot tightens. Sighing, I step back, staring at the stupid thing, and flap my tent dress to get air to my skin. What a pig this thing is. There's nothing I can do that will budge it. I stamp my feet and slap its white grimy door. Running through to the bedroom, I kneel and grab the big knife from under the mattress, the one Gio keeps there in case of intruders. Not that anyone would steal from here. Head high, a warrior to the fight, I stride back. I'll carve it, slice it, and loot its arctic treasure. One hand clenches around the rope, the other sweeps sweat from my face, then lowers to slash. The rope snaps, and the door grumbles open. Cockroaches? Hundreds of them? They scutter out of the cold onto the warm, sticky tiles. Soon there's a blanket of gleaming shells. The stench invades the air and seeps into my sunburnt skin. Will it cling there longer because my skin's raw from the sun? A few clamber onto my bare feet. I stand there and let them. Their legs or feet, or whatever you call them, terrorise my toes. My knees shake, throat stinging from screams. Someone knocks at the door, shouting. It's a woman. I understand some words, but can't make sense of what she's saying. She seems scared. Maybe the whole block of flats is a roach invasion. And these aren't normal cockroaches. These are the size of a baby rat. Of course, I get it. They were gorging on the food in the fridge. That's why they're fat. I move a foot, and then another, and back up against the wall. Each step makes me scream louder. The knocks on the door get fiercer. Someone's kicking it, trying to get in. More than one voice shouting. It could be two, maybe three, but I can't move from the corner. The front door bangs open, and footsteps rush towards me. The man carries a hammer, the woman a shoe high above her head. A little girl about three or four totters beside them. In her hand, she trails a pink teddy bear, much too close to the floor. I should run to her, save the teddy before the roaches scuttle aboard and party.
She's only a child. Any other adult would put their fears behind them and dive into a rescue mission. If only I could move. But I'm as frozen as I was back at the restaurant, at the top of those cellar stairs. And this is worse. Their legs. The smell. We've nothing like it in Scotland. The man plods across the room, and the roaches crunch into inky blots under the thud of his feet. He raises his hammer and shouts, "Bastardo!" Is he going to kill them one by one? But instead of crushing them, he throws open a door. A broom falls out of a cupboard. He grunts and looks around the small flat, under the table, behind the sofa, and in the main bedroom. They must think from my screams there's a strange man in here, and they've come to my rescue. The woman kicks a few cockroaches aside, then struts into the kitchen, holding the heel of her shoe like a knife. The man lowers the hammer to his side, shrugs and joins her. The little girl puts her teddy down on the table and picks up the fallen broom. She sweeps the cockroaches out onto the balcony and over the edge. The woman glances down at them as they tumble into space. She pats her daughter's head, as if saying, "Good girl," then catches my eyes.
"Non ti preoccupare, sono solo scarafaggi."
I lower my head. Scarafaggi? Cockroach? Another new word. She smiles, slips on her shoe, and walks towards me, arms wide. She checks my clothes, picks off a roach and throws it to the tiles.
"Tutti okay now,"
she says, as she turns me around. I run my hands down my clothes and shake my feet. The itch on my skin burrows into my mind. I dart out of the apartment and onto the landing, where I stand shaking. Nothing is going to tempt me back in. The man talks to his wife as they leave. They mention Giovanni's name and something to do with the door. Then they nod and take their daughter's hand. She giggles and turns towards me. I could lose myself in the dark night of her eyes.
"Hello, my name is Francesca. What's yours?"
I reply, "My name is Nikki."
"Come our house, it's safe,"
she says, and hands me her teddy. The ivory sofa is too perfect to sit on. My clothes too dark for its sumptuous cushions. On the walls are portraits in thick golden frames, and from the ceiling, crystal pendants sparkle from chandeliers. It's like a rich person lives here. A cream cabinet holds gold figurines and many different versions of Mary Magdalene. On each side of the sofa sit ornate jewelled lamps. The scent of leather is fresh and sharp. I'm thankful when Francesca slips her hand into mine and leads me out to the garden. A scatter of pillows in yellow, pink and green are piled up against an orange tree. A stack of books and dolls lie strewn across them. She sits down on a giant beanbag and tugs my hands to join her. When I do, she smiles and hands me a book. It's in English, and she climbs onto my lap and begs me to read.
"We want she speak the English. We buy the books,"
her mother says.
"But come, Francesca, leave the Nikki alone."
It's strange how the mother is dressed in white shorts and a denim halter neck. Even her hair is dyed blonde. Is that not forbidden here? I pull the cheap nylon from the heat of my legs. Francesca wriggles up onto my lap, wraps her arms around my neck and says,
"Please, I can't resist."
She reminds me of my little sister, and I nod to her mother. "It's okay." She smiles and ambles away. When I open the book, tears spring to my eyes. How wonderful to see words I understand once more. How I've missed my own language. Francesca hugs her teddy and cuddles in, and I tell her, "Once upon a time." The fresh scent of garlic and basil wafts around us, and her father walks over and hands me a cold beer. Its touch feels delicious against my warm skin. Some were a piano, please. And a woman sings along to the melody. I place the book down to listen, and Francesca leaps up from a lap and grabs an orange from the tree. She offers it like treasure.
You like the arancia?
Arancia. Orange. Another new word. And that's when I remember Gio. I'm not meant to leave the flat. The scuttle of the roaches returns to my skin, and I can't help but shudder. But when I look, there are none. Shouts rise from the patio, and Francesca tugs on my arm.
Mangiamo.
She smiles, and I follow her across the garden to a feast of scents, all the colours of the rainbow. Not a beige chip in sight. What if I can't eat it after all their kindness? Her mother pulls out a chair and gestures for me to sit, then pushes a plate towards me and motions to help myself. I ignore the salad and the fish with glassy eyes, reach for the thing that appears normal, and bite into hot bread. Mozzarella drips around my fingers. I twirl it around and scoop it back into my mouth. Her mother laughs and pulls a chair up closer. I am the Paola, she says, and pats her hand on my knee.
You okay, Nicoletta? You was happy?
I crumple into tears. Is it her touch or the way she reminds me of my home? It's so hard here, so far away. Gio's always out working, and I'm nothing to do, no one to talk to. And the flat is a dump, nothing like he promised, nothing like this palace. She takes a napkin to my eyes and hugs me. I hang my head and breathe deep, but snot dribbles down onto my legs. I brush it off, hoping no one notices. I miss Mum so much. Footsteps rush towards me, and arms scoop me up out of the chair.
My Nicky, no, you cry.
Gio clutches me high in his arms and kisses my tears. He twirls me softly around under the darkening sky.
The Paola, she phoned me. I come fast, I can. I go get the gun tomorrow. I kill all the cockroach, bang, bang. You see, Nicky, you see.
The sadness floats away on a giggle, and with his hands tighter on my waist, I lean back and spread out my arms like wings. Faster, I see, and Gio spins. Francesca jumps to her feet and claps in delight. But I don't miss the scowl Paolo darts at Gio.
Chapter 32. Mrs. Hawthorne, Edinburgh. My sisters are coming for lunch. It will be the first time they've been to the house. It's not that I haven't wanted them to before. I just had to make everything perfect. It wouldn't have done for them to witness all Clarissa's things. If her presence was so prominent, they'd not understand she was in the past. But she's eradicated now. All her finery heaped into skips and rotting in a landfill. Her local artist landscapes are stripped and replaced with more tasteful prints. The chintz of her and Charles's life banished with Farrow and Ball Manor House grey. Such a more refined palette. Except for one thing. This urn in my hands, which is adorned with a hand-painted peacock. Apparently it was her favourite bird. Who would choose a peacock unless they were pretentious and thought themselves something special? Far more tasteful to choose something simple, like a robin or even a sparrow. At least they don't parade around in a flashy manner. With a grunt of annoyance, I finish the dusting and place the urn back onto the shelf. It would only take a smidgen of a nudge for it to fall onto these wooden floors. It would certainly smash, contents spilling out like a clump of cement, and I'd grab the hoover, and that would be that. My hand clamps to my mouth. I back away and flop down onto the sofa. I must never utter those words out loud. How awful. Anyone else would protect its precious contents and ensure they pushed it back carefully against the wall, not leave it dangling near the edge. They'd have more respect for death. I twist my engagement ring. It's still a little too tight, even though the jeweler widened it. My fault, of course. I couldn't admit my hands were much fatter than perfect Clarissa Ballerina, and had accepted the alteration with a smile. Charles had lifted my hand, with tears clouding his eyes, saying it was fabulous to see it worn again. Our love had never felt so crowded. Ridiculous to have such hatred for a stranger, a woman I've never met. But she needs to vanish, so we can breathe. How hard can it be when she's dead? Jack barks and scampers past me into the hall. I jump up and follow him through. It'll be Charles back from collecting the Waitrose order for lunch. They've such a delightful selection. "Hi, baby," he says to Jack, and crouches to pat him, checking for cuts, scrapes, or missing paws. I roll my eyes behind his back and ask him, "Did you get everything?" "Yes, absolutely. And a little something to brighten up the dining room, too. Just a minute while I get them from the car." I carry the buffet tray into the kitchen to unwrap and arrange things on a silver platter. It will be such a treat for my sisters to eat something that's not from Asda. It will brighten up their day. When we were children, my mother thought Findus crispy pancakes were the height of luxury. Thank goodness I've moved up in the world since then. I pop the platter into the fridge, grab my cigarettes and lighter, and head for the garden. "Oh, have you got a moment?" Charles says, shuffling behind me. In his hand is a large bouquet, and he holds it towards me when I turn. The scent spins around the hall, and his eyes on mine sparkle. Like a child waiting for a gold star and a pat on the back. The flowers are magnificent, but peonies are her favourites, not mine. She spoils everything with her intrusions. I gather them into my arms and grant him a kiss. "They're beautiful. Thank you so much, darling." I'm rewarded with a lopsided grin, and he takes them back to trim and place in a vase. I cross the garden, sink onto the bench under the willow tree, light a cigarette and breathe in. The branches trail down around me. Swaying gently in the breeze, they help to shroud my shame. I fidget with a twig, pull off a catkin and roll it gently in my hand. Why have all the men I loved not loved me enough? Am I not smart? Are my tales not witty? Do I not measure up to other women's beauty? I've tried so hard to be what they want, but time after time I've failed. I clench my fist and crush the bud until its sticky sap coats my fingers like blood. Even my father abandoned my mother and left me behind. And I try harder than her to be the perfect partner. Yet it's never enough. Charles shouts from the terrace, "Your sisters are here!" He's bouncing from foot to foot, anxious and unsure of himself. I'd better rescue him. He's never great in social situations. "Yes, 1 minute." I lift the cigarette to my mouth, inhale until the glow burns my fingers, then throw it to the ground. I fix a smile to my mouth, smooth the wrinkles from my dress, and follow him back in. Mary and Judy were young when Dad left. It was a Sunday afternoon, and they were playing in their bedroom with tea sets and dolls. Mum had let them take a jug of squash upstairs and some jammy dodgers for a picnic. I was 15, in the next bedroom listening to music, when the arguing started downstairs. It happened most weekends, so I didn't pay much attention at first. They'd shout until it ended in Mum crying and Dad leaving the house, with a slam of the front door. In the morning at breakfast, everything would be back to normal, as if it never happened. But this time, their voices were low, and I couldn't make out some of the words. I crept down the stairs and stood one step from the bottom, where the reflections glimmered in the hall mirror. Mum wrung a dishcloth through her hands, her face red and blotchy, as if she'd been crying, and Dad stood at the front door with his shoulders slouched. Dad always stood tall. He crouched enough when working down the coal mine that when he wasn't working, he wanted to be closer to the sky. So I knew something was wrong. A suitcase was at his feet, the same one he packed for our summer trips to Blackpool. Why would he go on holiday without us? "I'm going now," he said. Mum replied, "Okay." And he picked up the case, turned the latch on the door, and walked out. I stood there, blinking back emotion. Something very bad was happening. I wanted to run back upstairs and cuddle my sisters, protect them from the heartache that would destroy their innocence. But I was wrong. This was our dad. He'd never leave us. I forced my feet forwards, opened the door and shouted, "Dad!" But he never turned round. So I chased down the path after him. I tugged at the hem of his suit jacket, asking him where he was going. But he pushed me aside, climbed into his car, pressed down the button, and locked me out. "Go home and look after Mum. She'll need you," he said. Then he drove off. Not even a kiss. How could he leave his princess? I stood there for hours, believing he'd come back, change his mind. But he never did. And that was the last time I saw him, until 50 years later, when my sister, Judy, phoned and said he was dying. I brush my tears away. What's wrong with me today? I can't let my sister see me so fractured. "Get a grip, you old fool." Charles has set up the dining table beautifully. The food looks wonderful, and the peonies are the perfect touch. No one need know I hate them. My sisters are seated, and Judy has brought her granddaughter, Sophie, along. She jumps up and runs over to me and wraps her arms around my waist in a tight hug. I ruffle her hair. "What age are you now, Sophie? 3? She sighs and with her hands on her hips says,
"No, I'm 5, of course."
I laugh and my sisters join in. Sophie's the cutest thing. Judy is lucky.
"The house is beautiful,"
Mary says.
"I love the way you've decorated it all. It's really pretty."
Judy smiles.
"Mary's right. You'll have to give us a tour later."
I'm lightheaded from their praise. Charles carries in tea, the best china, matching sugar bowl, perfectly presented on a silver tray. Mary grins.
"Do you remember when we were wee and played usherettes with Mum's plastic trees? We wanted to be one when we grew up."
I laugh. "Yeah, we thought it was the best job in the world." Judy adds,
"Because we thought we'd get to see all the films for free."
Mary suddenly gasps and leaps from her chair.
My goodness, I forgot about your ring. I've been dying to see it.
Judy pushes back her chair to join her, and I hold my hand up as they ooh and ah. I blush, hoping they don't ask what shop it came from or realise it's second hand. They'd not understand. I remove my hand and the threat. Mary turns to Charles.
It's perfect. I'm so happy for you both.
Thank you. I'm very fortunate indeed, Charles replies. My sisters smile. It's not a polite gesture. I know them well enough to understand its genuine warmth. They like him, as I knew they would. Charles is easy to love. Sophie is fidgeting beside me, kicking her feet against the table, bored with the adult setting and chat. Let's eat. Charles, serve the tea. And Sophie, why don't you come with me, and I'll get you some orange juice and a chocolate biscuit. You can watch some cartoons in the living room. Does that sound good?
Yes, please. Thank you.
She stands and places her tiny hand in mine. She has such perfect manners. But then I wouldn't expect anything less from Judy. She brought her boys up with the same decorum. As we walk through to the kitchen, Sophie jumps up and down.
Oh, what a big television! Can I go through and see it, please?
I tell her yes, and that I'll be there soon with her snack. And she bounces off, with Jack padding softly behind her. I've missed out on so much. It's no surprise my sisters are so close to each other, and I feel left out. Except for the occasional visits, I've been absent from their lives, too devoted to my prestigious career and the endless search for love. I'd forgotten how happy I could be when it was just us three. I grab the orange juice and a couple of biscuits and stroll into the living room. Sophie is standing on her tiptoes, her arms stretched out to the bookcase. She's reaching for the urn.
Pretty bird, I love peacocks. They're my favourite thing in the world.
My mouth opens in shock. I see what's going to happen. She's not tall enough to grasp it, and her fingers are spinning it closer to the edge. A few seconds more, and it will teeter and fall. She won't catch it because her hands are too small. With a clatter, it will crash to the floor. Smash. The accidental murder of an unwelcome ghost. My feet are frozen beneath me. Time slows. My hands tremble and shake. The orange juice splashes out over the glass. Jack scrambles towards me and licks the floor. We're sitting together on the sofa. Sophie giggled when I jumped towards her, thinking I was playing a game. When I moved the urn higher onto a windowsill, her bottom lip jutted out. But now she's fine. The thing is, the vase has a special meaning for your great uncle Charles. It belonged to a lady that he loved very much, but she's gone now. Sophie settles back into the cushions, curls her legs up, and tilts her head to rest on her hand. Her big blue eyes gaze up.
Is the lady in heaven? Like my hamster floor?
Strands of hair have escaped from her pigtail. I lean over and brush them back from her face. Yes, darling, just like your hamster. Exactly like that. Her lips widen into a smile that displays every tooth in her mouth.
We have to take good care of the vase then, until she comes back. It happens at Easter, my daddy says.
I plant a soft kiss on her cheek. Yes, You are so right, Sophie. She beams, proud of herself, and says,
Can you switch on the television, please?
And just like that, she's moved on. It's time for me to leave my childish insecurities behind and do the same.
Chapter 33.
Ronnie, Liverpool. Half-tam, and I'm sterilising the stench of bedroom lies with non-toxic paint fumes. I plunge a brush into a tin of Dulux, load it thick, and slap my rage onto the wall. Scrawling, over and over, F you, Graham, and F you, Tom, until I'm out of space. Teal facade, which was darker in the shop, splatters my skin, and I'm drenched in sweat. I'll need to douse myself in a bath of turpentine. Pity I can't do the same to them. I crumple to the floor, panting for breath. But shit, it's been worth it. I've demanded the details of Graham's confession, but he thinks he can gaslight me. Exhibit A, misunderstanding. He explains that I was upset that night, and due to my heightened emotions, I must have misheard him. He uses air quotes to emphasise what he truly said.
If you've someone in there, Ronnie, I hope you're using discretion.
It's laughable. I'm a head teacher. I'm programmed to distinguish speech. I wouldn't last long in the job if I expelled students for using the word ruck for fuck. Exhibit B. Subterfuge. He was drunk and desperately needed a pee, but I wouldn't answer the door, so he just said he'd a confession as an excuse to get in. As if. Exhibit C. Deflection. He changes the subject, suddenly becomes interested in an issue at school that will reel me in. Oh, that problem with the English teacher. I've solved it. But if you don't want to hear...
Of course I do.
Exhibit D. Attack. He doesn't understand why I've become obsessed about something he's never said. Perhaps, he suggests, it's me that needs to confess, and not him. I give him that. But I still heard what I heard. It's pathetic. And yet I won't drop it. I just can't. He was going to tell me something, but at the last minute changed his mind. Well, fuck that. I'll never let it go. It will twist in my mind and fester. I pour some paint into a tree and grab a roller. I need to smooth out the words of my anger, or the landlord will think I'm a nutter. It's a shame, because it's quite artistic. But if anything were to happen to Graham or Tom, I'd be the police's chief suspect. Not that I'd hear from Tom's slimebag again, and Graham's keeping his distance. I've had it with men. And you know what? I can't be arsed with this either. I hurl the roller into the tree, strip to my underwear, and stamp down the stairs. There's a pile of student reports on the worktop in the kitchen, waiting for my signature. But I like to read each one and write a personal note. Not in the mood for that. I open the freezer door and grab the vodka. I sit on the sofa and throw a drink down my throat. The sting of the alcohol makes me cough, but I like it. There was a guy once, don't know his name, Kenneth or Kenny, or maybe it was Ken. It doesn't really matter. Just another bastard. I used to go to the pub after school when I first started teaching. A quick drink always turned into us staying late and dancing. And he was the DJ. Sigh. A DJ. Should have known better. After he wore me down with how special I was, I thought I'd be the one to tame him. We dated for 6 months, and at first, it was amazing. I even met his mother and loved her. But then, the calls dwindled. He stopped coming around as much, and when he did, he seldom stayed over.
He worked nights, and his gigs had become busier. Plus, his mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. She wasn't coping, and he'd move back in to support her. Of course I understood, but things felt so different. So, I tried harder to make his life easier. Bought him small presents to cheer him up and kept things pressure-free. Until I was shopping in Sainsbury and saw them both, him and his mother, at the checkout. "I hope you're feeling okay now," I said to her. "Me?" she said. "Nothing wrong with me, dear. Couldn't be better." I turned to Kenny, who shrugged and winked. "No harm done, hun." I left my shopping in the trolley and walked out, his lies forcing my head low. The paint's dried on my skin. I scratch the edges and peel it off, then flick it across the room. I should paint more. I like the sting. My mum was always decorating. Once one room was finished, she'd start again somewhere else. Maybe she did it for the same reason. I draw the bottle to my mouth and swallow some down. I need a pee, but can't be bothered moving. I cross my legs and hold it in. The phone rings. It'll be Graham with today's excuse for why he can't come round. But if I don't answer, I'll spend all night overthinking what he might have said. "Hey." "Hi, Ronnie. How are you, gorgeous?" I sit up straight and edge forward on the sofa. "Tom?" He laughs down the phone. I want to scream, but stifle it in. Have to hear what shit he's going to spout. "I guess you didn't expect to hear from me. What you up to?" I gulp back some vodka, place the bottle at my feet, and force out a laugh. "Course not. I thought you were away with your job." "Ah, that fell through. Last minute thing, you know." "Fucking liar." "All right. Shame. Anyway, what about you? What you up to?" That's twice he's asked that now. It's obvious what the fucker is after. "Nothing really. Having a drink and chilling out." "Sorry about before, Ronnie. I shouldn't have said the things I said or acted like such a prick. That's not who I am. I guess it was the drink and the stress of leaving the next day. I meant it when I said how much I like you. I've missed you these last few weeks." I missed him too. I'd looked forward to his daily phone calls in school, the rushing to my office like a teenager again. He'd made me laugh, softened the edges of the D. "So what about it, Ron? I'll come round, make it up to you." Hands stray to my arms, scrape the scabs of paint from my skin, and my lips transform into a smile. "You were a bastard, Tom." His sigh is loud, dramatic. "I know, I know. Let me show you I'm not that guy. Please, Ronnie, you know me better than that. I was a dick to lose you." Another gulp of vodka. I swirl it around in my mouth, savouring the acidic burn. "Okay." "Great. I'm outside in the car."
"Outside? Outside my house?"
I'm in underwear and stink of sweat, splattered with streaks of paint. I stand, stumble, and lean onto the chair. I've also had too much to drink. "Give me 5 minutes, Tom. I need to get changed and run to the loo." I cut him off, run into the kitchen, and grab the washing up bowl, then scramble upstairs, pausing to cross my legs once or twice as I go. At the top, I pull my knickers down, hobble through the bathroom door, and squat. The gush of piss makes me sigh. But no time to loiter in the minute. I jump up, brush a comb through my hair, and throw on some oversized sunnies. There's a knock on the front door. I run to the bedroom window, open it wide, shout, Just a minute. Then bend, lift the bowl, and haul it over the side to drench the dirty rat. I laugh and hold my hand to my mouth. I'm scared to look, but dying to see at the same time. It's batshit crazy, but he deserves it. I stick my head out the window and look down. Piss off! I shout.
Are you fucking crazy?
Graham shouts.
What the fuck was that?
My mouth falls open. I pull the window shut and close the curtains. Slouch down to the floor. What the fuck have I done? Showered and subdued with a glass of red wine, Graham sits on a stool behind me as I stir-fry some chicken and rice.
So, I take it the piss was meant for Tom,
he says. I stifle a giggle at the image of Graham, standing there flicking piss off his hair. It stung his eyes, he says, and was surprisingly hot. He coughs. He's either coming down with something, or his words are choking him.
I know about Tom. The night you went to the cinema, I saw you both outside. I shouted on you.
So, it was Graham's voice after all that I heard.
My mate didn't have enough cash, so he stopped to grab some, and I saw your face when he handed you a rose. The way it lit up. After that, I couldn't enjoy my night.
I stir the sauce. The ginger tickles my nose and I sneeze. Poor Graham. Distracted from fucking around.
I was furious. Kept thinking about you with him. What did he have that I didn't?
Welcome to my world, fucker.
So I left the club early and ran over here. But when you let me in, I could smell him. I knew he'd been here and that you'd slept with him. You were crying, Ronnie. Why would you cry over him?
The chicken is sticking to the pan, burning. I stir in the soya sauce. Okay, this is it. He's finishing things.
I've spent the last couple of weeks working out my feelings, asking myself why I was so jealous. Today, I decided I was ready to talk. But when I saw Tom outside, I blew. Dragged him away from the door and told him to get to Lost before I beat him up.
I grab a couple of pleats from the cupboard and some knives and forks. The drawer could do with a good clean. The cupboard too.
That's not like me. So, my confession. The one you've dissected with a magnifying glass.
Here it comes. Don't throw the wok at him.
It was never part of my plan, Ron. But the only answer that made sense is that I must love you.
What do I say to that? He stands, switches the cooker off, takes my hand, and leads me to the bedroom. The smell of paint is fainter, and there's still a mess everywhere. I lift the plastic sheets from the bed and tell Graham I won't be long in the shower, but he shakes his head and pulls me into a kiss. I giggle and tumble across the bed.
So you'll love me, huh?
I tease. He slaps my arse, says,
yep, I guess I do,
and pulls me back to him. His lips caress the back of my neck, but then he stops, points to the wall.
Ronnie, what does footfug mean?
I laugh, and unfurl from his arms, and escape from the question. In the shower, only one thought dominates, twirls and swirls inside me. This is it. I've won.